This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, for the first time, the federal government will provide money to reimburse hospitals and doctors for the emergency care they provide to illegal immigrants. $1 billion, to be exact, set aside by the Bush administration to cover the medical expenses incurred treating about 8 to 10 million illegals every year. This new program addresses a problem that hospitals face, particularly in border states. Federal law requires hospitals to provide emergency care to anyone who needs it. Up till now, the considerable cost of treating illegal immigrants has been absorbed by public hospitals, by physicians, and by the states. But if Washington is going to pick up part of the bill, the government wants proof that public money is being spent properly. The first version of this new program required hospitals to ask indigent patients about their citizenship. After hospitals, doctors, and immigrant groups, rights groups objected, the government proposed a set of less direct questions. In a moment, we'll talk with medical professionals on the front lines to learn more about this program and how it will play out in the ER, what it means for doctors, immigrants, and for the states. Later in the program, actor, author, and sleight-of-hand artist Ricky Jay joins us to talk about card tricks and con games. But first, illegal immigrants and health care. If you have questions about this new federal program, give us a call. We'd especially like to hear from those of you who work in an ER that does see a lot of immigrants. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Julie Rovner, NPR health policy correspondent, has been following the evolution of this new program. She joins us here in Studio 3A. Always nice to have you on the program, Julie.
Nice to be here.
So, to begin with, why is the federal government going to pay for the health care of illegal immigrants?
Because legislators from border states want them to. It's the short answer. This was something that was actually included in the Medicare prescription drug law that passed in 2003, although it had tried to catch a ride on several different bills over the years, particularly led by lawmakers from Arizona, particularly led by Senator John Kyle, Republican of Arizona.
So that's the political reason why they're willing to do it. What are the broader reasons why this is in the interest of the federal government to do it?
Well, it's certainly in the interest of someone to do it. There's definitely an agreement that illegal immigrants, for whatever their status, do need health care, and it's actually dangerous to everyone else if they don't get it, particularly if they have contagious diseases that they could then spread among non-illegal residents. So there's not just a humanitarian, but it's good for the rest of us if everybody who is here and needs health care can get it. The question is this hot potato of who pays for it. And the states have been particularly irritated since 1986 when this law was passed that requires them to provide emergency room care to anyone who presents himself, but then doesn't take any responsibility for paying the bill.
Now, which states are going to be the beneficiaries of this $1 billion in federal largesse?
Well, actually, every state is going to be the beneficiary of some of it. Two-thirds of the money is divided amongst the 50 states and the Washington, D.C., based on the estimate of their illegal alien population. The remaining one-third of the money is going to be distributed among the top six states that have the most, and those states are in order of how much money they're getting: California, Texas, Arizona, New York, Florida, and New Mexico. So those states will get proportionately more in addition to it. But every state will get something, including, I think there's four or five states where they're estimated to have fewer than 1,000, and they'll get sort of a token amount.
Mm-hmm. Now, is $1 billion going to substantially reduce the problem?
Depends how you define substantially. There are various estimates of how much this costs. Senator Kyle, who, as I mentioned, is one of the people who's been most behind this, uses an estimate of $1 to $2 billion. The Los Angeles Times this morning had an estimate from L.A. County alone of $340 million. A California Hospital Association estimates $500 million. Remember, that's just California. So it's really hard to know exactly how much it is, but I think everybody agrees it's a lot of money, and a lot more money than the federal government is providing. There's hope because, as they say, it's symbolic that for the first time the federal government is at least acknowledging that it has some part of a responsibility for paying for this care that it is, after all, indirectly requiring.
And an unfunded mandate, in other words.
Now,
however, if this program was created and tagged along, as you suggested, to the Medicare bill, which it had nothing to do with, does that suggest that this program is going to go beyond this one-time $1 billion?
Well, not clear. Certainly the federal deficit is large and getting larger. Interestingly enough, this is being pushed by some of the most fiscally conservative legislators in the House, the ones who are saying we really need to cut the budget. I might point out, it's $1 billion over 4 years. So it's $250 million this year, next year, the year after, and the year after that, once it is not, as we say, in the baseline. So they would need to come up with more money if they were going to continue the program.
If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Let's talk with Robert. Robert's calling from Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah, hi. I'm an emergency medical services, and I'm a paramedic manager. In this new prescription bill, do they cover emergency medical services, ambulances, paramedics in the field? As I'm sure you're aware, when people call 911, there's a universal service law there, too, and we have to treat everybody regardless of ability to pay. And I'll take my answer off the line.
Thanks for the call, Robert.
Yes, we should have mentioned that. It does also cover ambulance costs.
Now, to get to the controversial point in this law, well, there's a lot of controversial points, but to get to at least one of them, the federal government, understandably, wants some accounting as to how many illegal immigrants are being treated. Therefore, they want some documentation for undocumented people.
And that has been the tricky part of this, and it's why it's taken so long to get to the place where we are today with this final guidance. Originally, the government said that they basically wanted the hospitals to be able to prove that these people were, after all, illegal aliens that they were treating for free. And there was a hue and cry from the hospitals themselves and from basically immigrant groups that said, look, if you do that, if you basically make hospital personnel immigration officers, then people who need health care won't come in. If they come in, tell them they're here illegally, they'll be deported. That's the antithesis of the point of getting people who need care in for treatment. So finally, they settled on this compromise where they're going to have to ask them. They will not have to ask them if they're here illegally. They will have to ask people if they're covered by Medicaid, in which case they wouldn't be eligible, if they're foreign-born, or if they have border crossing cards. Now, these are applied to people from Mexico who are mostly in Arizona and New Mexico. Basically, if they will not say if they're foreign-born, there's a pot of money set aside for those sort of questionable but presumed. So this is what people are hoping is the compromise where you can get some idea that the federal government won't just be, you know, spending money for who knows what, but you also won't deter people, illegal immigrants, from coming in to get care when they need it.
Now, as I understand it, the hospitals will be required to make copies of any documents they have, not necessarily to provide them to the federal government, but to be there in case an inspector comes and wants to audit.
That's right. And hospitals do get audited by the federal government. I mean, remember, we're only talking about hospitals who accept Medicare, because that's what the requirement for emergency treatment applies to, our hospitals who accept Medicare. So hospitals do get audited, and they will have to keep these on file, and that's of concern to a lot of hospitals.
In rare cases, as the government at least lays it out, in rare cases, they say information might be provided in criminal investigations.
I think the distinction that they're trying to make is that deportation proceedings are civil actions, and that this will not be used for deportation proceedings. If this will not be used for any civil actions, it could be used for criminal actions in cases of smuggling or gang-related activities. There's the possibility that they could come after the hospital to try to get information in criminal investigations, but that they won't be used for routine deportation proceedings, which I think is what most people are worried about in going to the hospital.
Is there any opposition to this program?
Yes, from both sides. Actually, the House, in order to get the Medicare bill through the Senate, they needed to put this in to get Senator Kyle to vote for it. In order to get it through the House, they had to promise Congressman Dana Rohrabacher from California that he could vote on a separate bill that would, in fact, require hospitals to determine whether people are here legally or not. And that bill was voted on last summer, and it went down dramatically. I forget the exact vote, but it got not that many votes, because I think people decided that this was probably not the best policy in terms of getting people care that they need. And as I say, in terms of not just protecting these illegal immigrants, but in protecting the rest of the community.
Julie Rovner, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
NPR's health policy correspondent, Julie Rovner, joined us here in Studio 3A. Arizona is on the forefront of providing emergency health care to illegal immigrants. Today, the Arizona Republic newspaper reported that one of the hardest hit counties along the U.S.-Mexican border is Pima, Arizona. In the year 2000 alone, hospitals there incurred $24 million in costs from treating illegal paralegals. Joining us now to talk about the hospital side of this story is Greg Pivirotto, the Chief Executive Officer of the University Medical Center in Tucson, Arizona. He's with us by phone from his office in Tucson. Nice of you to join us today.
Good morning.
Tucson is in Pima County. How much is it, that figure was from 2000. How much does it cost your hospital now to provide emergency care for illegal immigrants?
We estimate this year one hospital will spend about $12 million treating foreign nationals.
In 1 year?
In 1 year.
Arizona, as I understand under the formula, stands to receive $45 million over the next 4 years. That doesn't sound like it's going to cut much into your expenses.
We estimate that it will reimburse us as one institution be probably 25 to 30%.
Well, so that's substantial.
It is, and we're greatly appreciative of it.
What percentage of the patients in your ER are illegal immigrants?
Oh, that number I don't have off the top of my head.
Any ballpark guess?
No, I'm sorry.
All right.
We see probably 80 a month coming in through our emergency room.
And as I understand it, one of the principles, and I think Julie mentioned it before, that the hospitals cared about is, even if this is not providing all of the money for this, for the first time, the federal government is accepting responsibility to pay for at least some of it.
That's correct. This is not a local issue. It's not even a state issue. It is a federal issue. It's a national issue. And so, yes, this is a recognition of the problem.
And obviously, you've been pushing for this for quite a while.
Yes, we have.
Now, the federal government issued its final guidelines today. What about these issues of paperwork or documentation?
Which documentation are you referring to?
Well, finding out through indirect questions about their immigration status.
That's not an issue at all. And I may be saying something I regret, but quite frankly, it is not controversial. We ask people wherever they're from, and they tell us quite openly. In fact, about 2 years ago, if a person leaves here and doesn't make any makes no intent of paying their bill or even rectifying their bill with us, after a seven-day head start, we will report them to immigration. At the time, this was said this was going to scare people away, that people would not seek health care. The fact is our numbers are up by 50% since we started that 2 years ago. So it has had no negative effect on people seeking care.
Our guests are Greg Pivirotto, Chief Executive Officer at the University Medical Center in Tucson, Arizona. We've also asked NPR's Julie Rovner to come back into the conversation as well to provide her expertise. She's our health policy correspondent. Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Maria. Maria is calling from Detroit.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
My question pertains to, I work in an inner city hospital in Detroit. About 20% of our patient population are Hispanic. We have a large Mexican contingent. And yet 50% of our patients are residents right here in the States who are indigent and cannot pay for their health care. What implication does this have for possibly putting together some type of program so that everybody gets health care, not just illegal immigrants?
Mm-hmm. Julie?
Well, certainly that's an issue that's being debated in Washington. People would like some money, and there's certainly, you know, an argument to be made. Gee, why are we now paying for people who are here illegally when there are people who are here legally who can't get health care? Although one would argue that if they are that indigent that they should be eligible for the Medicaid program.
Greg Pivirotto, is this an issue in Tucson?
Well, yes, it's a significant issue. But again, as was just stated, these people should be able to qualify for the Medicaid program.
Maria, thanks very much.
Thanks very much.
Okay, appreciate it. And Greg Pivirotto, remind us, how big is your hospital?
We're a university teaching hospital. We have 365 beds, which is actually a small university hospital, but that's our size.
That's your size. Are you the largest hospital in the area?
We actually are not. There is one hospital that is larger than us.
And I wonder, when immigrants come into the emergency room, do they know for the most part that they're eligible, that they don't have to pay if they don't have it?
If they don't know when they arrive, they find out very quickly.
How?
It's interesting because most people, when they arrive within a day or two, they will have family members who join them at the hospital. And they'll very quickly learn how the system works.
So this word spreads rather rapidly.
It does.
There was concern earlier in this debate. We had Congressman Rohrabacher on the program, and he was concerned that this kind of program might encourage people to cross the border specifically for the purpose of getting health care.
That is a concern. And, in fact, when you read the document that CMS put out, they talk about people who come across the border in a parole status. That doesn't mean they're criminals. What that means is they actually present at the border with a medical emergency, and the border just waves them through so that they can get their care. So a woman might show up in labor, a person might show up who is bleeding, and they will be waved through. Those are referred to as medical parolees.
Let's get another caller on the line. Eric. Eric's calling from Miami.
Hi, how are you doing this afternoon?
Very well, thank you.
I am a medical director of an emergency department in Florida, and I actually have a couple concerns about this legislation and some of the unanticipated consequences of the legislation. One of the things I think you just alluded to was regard to the situation where you have immigrants who are allowed to enter the country to seek medical care. One of the problems that I've found since I've begun working in Florida is a lot of residents of other countries do use the United States for the quality of their medical care and frequently use the emergency department as a point of entry. For example, at one hospital where I worked at, frequently what would happen is immigrants would land at the airport, and immediately upon landing at the airport, they would call 911 to be transported to an emergency department, and they would come with their medical files in tow from their foreign countries. And as a result of that, we were required legally to intervene and to provide them with medical care. The other concern that I have is the unanticipated consequence of the increase in volume that a lot of emergency departments may wind up being subjected to if word gets out, you know, that this is another way in which medical care can be provided for free, as opposed to substituting care that is provided in primary care centers, which oftentimes would be more appropriate for a lot of the people who are using the emergency department.
But
I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Okay, Eric, thanks very much for the call. But Greg Pivirotto, as I understand, it's the emergency room where this program takes effect and where the money is available.
That is correct.
And do you share Greg's concerns?
Oh, absolutely. We feel those are concerns as well. What we've done here is we've started to create clinics on the other side of the border. And we've done that, and we've seen some real success in that, where people are now getting comfortable staying on the other side of the border to get their care.
Let's get another caller in. And hello, are you there? No, obviously I've managed to mess it up. Let me see if I can now hang up the phone. There we go. We're going to get the hang of this job sooner or later. Pushing buttons, boy, it's a real thrill. Tyler. Tyler's on the line with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I was wondering, has there ever been any discussion whatsoever of possibly petitioning the Mexican government to assist with any of the funds? Because I know that there certainly hasn't been any deterrent to keeping people from leaving in such great numbers, and I was just wondering if there's ever been any discussion at all about petitioning the Mexican government for assistance in some of these programs that are becoming sort of an increasing burden to the American taxpayer.
Julie, I assume he means home government, whatever that may be. Often it is Mexico.
Certain, yes, and remember, we're not just talking about Mexico, although
certainly
obviously
I understand.
Right, in the case of Texas and Arizona and New Mexico and California, to some extent, we're largely talking about Mexico. Obviously, immigration is a huge issue between the two countries, and there are lots of discussions, and there are starting to be, you know, clinics in Mexico cooperative efforts. So it's not something that people are ignoring. It's just a very difficult problem.
Certainly. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Tyler. Email question from Clara May Highfill in Lawrence, Kansas. Why don't businesses and corporations that benefit from low-wage hiring of immigrants be required to pay in some way for the emergency medical care, either through a tax or health insurance? Has that ever been proposed on Capitol Hill, Julie?
Oh, yes. I'm certainly we're looking at it in California. I mean, not just for the emergency care, but, you know, why aren't businesses required to offer health insurance to everyone? It's simply, I could see that happening before the idea of having a tax on businesses to pay for illegal workers, which, of course, if they're caught, that's a crime for the business.
That's illegal.
That's right. That's why it's called illegal.
Point out that they do already pay.
How?
Tax dollars that are being used in corporate
taxes. Oh, sure, yes.
Taxes.
Yep. Here's Joseph. Joseph's calling from Kansas City.
Yes. My comment is that most private hospitals, not the chain ones, but the individual private hospitals, they claim they're nonprofit anyway, and they're getting the incentive and the benefits of not paying any taxes, which is sometimes millions of dollars. So why do they have to be paid back?
Well, this addresses, well, there's certain eligibility here requirements, Julie Rovner, in the law.
Well, there's the issue of charity care. In fact, going back to the caller from Florida who talked about people, you know, arriving at the airport and then calling an ambulance with their medical files, obviously not with the intent of going to the emergency room and being discharged, but with the intent of going to the emergency room and being admitted to the hospital, it's important to remember that the federal law only requires that patients be stabilized, not that they be admitted and given treatment for whatever they need. However, from the hospital's point of view, particularly these not just nonprofit hospitals, religious hospitals, hospitals with a mission, they tend to not then dump people out on the street. And that's part of where the difficulty comes in also, is what do you do with these patients? But no one, you know, there's a large amount of charity care. There's obviously a big debate going on, not about immigrants, but about the uninsured residents who are being charged what many consider excessive prices when they have to go to the hospital. And, you know, why, if these hospitals are, you know, supposedly have a charitable mission, why aren't they giving them enough charity care? And this is obviously a continuing dispute. But as someone once said about Kaiser Permanente, which is a nonprofit HMO, that they were nonprofit and darn good at it. If you lose too much money, you can't keep your doors open.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. It should be pointed out, we are nonprofit, but this care actually threatens our very existence. And that's why it needs to be acknowledged.
Threatens your existence.
Yes, it does.
I also wanted to follow up on Julie's point about the legislation requires that patients be stabilized and no more. That must be an extremely difficult fine judgment. Is it case by case?
It's also an issue because, think about it, if a person's badly hurt, they come into you and they're in critical condition. Let's say within 2 or 3 days you can now call them stable. That hardly means they're ready to go out the door. But the way the letters were written as of yesterday, it would say the federal government is only going to pay to that point where they're no longer in a life-threatening position, even though they might be in the hospital for another 5, 6, or 10 days. We had a young fellow who was, he tried to jump a train, lost both his legs. We probably had him stable within a couple weeks, but he was in the hospital for probably 5 to 6 weeks.
And so, under this program, the last month of that wouldn't have been picked up.
That's correct.
Yeah, Joseph, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And let's see if we can talk with John. And John's calling from Denver, Colorado.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. The emergency room is often used as a entryway for injured and ill patients to get immediate care. Does the legislation provide any relief for a surgeon that is called into the hospital to care for these patients that would otherwise end up effectively donating his time in the operating room for that patient?
Julie?
Yes, it does, and that's the whole point. In fact, there have been stories about doctors who have given up hospital privileges because they end up being called into the emergency room for these patients who they're not going to get paid for, and foregoing paying patients while they're caring for these non-paying patients. So, yes, it's emergency care, but also for the hospitals, the doctors, and the ambulance services.
John? Can I follow that up?
Yep.
Will the mechanism be similar to a Medicaid or a Medicare billing system to the federal government?
Greg Piverato, do you know about that?
The answer to that is yes. It will follow the Medicare guidelines, although, again, as you mentioned earlier, there will be this cutoff when you assume that the patient is stabilized.
Thank you very much.
John, thanks for the call. And Greg Piverato, we wanted to thank you for your time today.
Sure.
Greg Piverato is the Chief Executive Officer of the University Medical Center in Tucson, Arizona, and he joined us by phone from his office there in Tucson. As we mentioned earlier, in order to pay for illegal immigrant care, the federal government demands some proof that the people being treated are, in fact, illegal immigrants. There's controversy over how exactly doctors and hospitals should seek that information. Maria Gomez is President and CEO of Mary's Center for Maternal and Child Care here in Washington, D.C. That serves a largely Hispanic clientele. She's joined us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
When a patient without legal status goes to your center requiring emergency care, what do you do?
Well, presently we stabilize them at the center as a community health center, and then we call the doctors at the hospital where we are, and we send the patient, and we usually, prior to the patient going there, we know whether the patient has Medicaid or not or qualifies for it or not.
Mm-hmm.
But we have made arrangements with the hospitals that certain care will be provided. And in the city, there's certain, there's the emergency Medicaid law. There's also this whole network of providers that have been providing free care.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, there's a very free flow between the primary care and the tertiary care places.
And are you concerned that these new requirements may upset that free flow?
Well, definitely, because I think that when we're asking people for certain border visas or foreign IDs or any kind of visas, I think it's not only that it's going to affect the people that may have those specific visas, but it's also people who are really a large portion of people in this general area, in the metro area, who are actually green card holders,
mm-hmm.
who are wanting to be citizens.
Legal immigrants, in other words.
Legal immigrants, yeah. Documented immigrants who actually are looking forward to becoming citizens and who've been told, that they shouldn't be of any burden to any area hospital or any kind of the society as a whole. And I think that if we were to say to them that they were going to be asked all these questions, I think a lot of people will not go.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about immigration and health care. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Maria Gomez, earlier we heard Greg Pivarato talking about Tucson and his hospital there, saying they ask questions about immigration status all the time. It's not a problem in his hospital.
Right, and I'm surprised. I'm surprised that it must be that it's either that they are doing the same kind of care that we're doing here in the District of Columbia in terms of the hospitals, that people are not being jeopardized because of their status. But I think that this new law is very clear that we will have to say to patients that if they go to such and such hospital, they will be asked certain data. And I know from the HIPAA, the Health Information Protection Act, that much of that act really is geared towards giving government the ability to get information about health information about individuals.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, yeah, it was to protect the patients from their information and for them to get their own information, but it was also the other side of that, it was to actually provide hospitals with that ability to get that information.
Do you ask your patients for documentation?
No, we don't. But basically, what we say to clients is, do you qualify for Medicaid? And we go through a process of questions. We do qualify anyone that goes through that process, but we do not document otherwise, except for the people that do qualify for Medicaid.
And if you're hoping to get some of this money in reimbursement, will you change your procedures as of today?
Well, that's an interesting piece. That the fact is that the community health centers are not going to be eligible for that money at all. And that the interesting thing about all of this is that under this administration, they have been very, very generous in terms of providing a lot of community health centers. In this city alone, we have gotten 2 community health centers in the last year assigned in this particular area. There's 3 of them within about less than a mile radius, and none of those community health centers are going to be eligible for that money.
Mm-hmm. See if we can get one more caller in, and this is Suzanne, who's calling from Denver.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm a doctor, a hospitalist in the greater Denver area, and I've had occasion over the past several years to admit patients, especially in one particular hospital, who were illegal, and they were admitted into the hospital and then cared for during that time by several physicians, underwent procedures, whatever,
mm-hmm.
and that seems to me that it wouldn't count as emergency care and therefore still not be reimbursed under the system. First of all,
Julie Robner, is she right?
That's correct.
Okay, go ahead, Suzanne.
Okay, and second, my most recent interesting case was 2 months ago when a 19-year-old presented in severe end-stage renal failure and was admitted to my service, and we were unable to get him signed up with Medicaid quickly, and he stayed in the hospital, and I rounded on him every day for 4 weeks. Just getting routine hemodialysis 3 times a week, and there was nothing else wrong with him, so that he could get signed up for Medicaid and then be eligible for outpatient dialysis. So who reimburses the hospital for that kind of thing?
Julie?
That's why hospitals provide, you know, uncompensated care.
Suzanne, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but thank you very much for the call. Maria Gomez, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Maria Gomez, President and CEO for Mary Center for Maternal and Child Care here in Washington, D.C. And again, Julie Rovner here with us in Studio 3A. This is NPR News.